Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Troubadour Podcast. This is Sunday Morning Poetry, and I'm a little bit different. I'm in Cleveland. This is actually being recorded on Thursday, the last day of OCON. So it's been a busy day. That's the Objectivist Conference 2019. And this is the only time I had to do it. I was just at the gym, so I'm still dressed in that attire. I might be still a little sweaty. So thanks for bearing with me. But I was very inspired by Lisa Van Dam's talks on literature and the quest of meaning, quest for meaning, and the life and poetry of John Keats. What I wanted to do quickly, so I'm going to try to make this episode of Sunday Morning Poetry quicker than normal because I have other things to go to. There's closing reception, all that good stuff, and going on. So I'm going to get this recorded, put it, and I'll post it on Sunday, and so I'll try to get this done. But anyway, I wanted to quickly talk about something that came up a couple of times at the Objectivist Conference. And if you weren't there, that's fine. Check out the YouTube page for the Ayn Rand Institute. And I'm going to give a couple of recommendations that were mentioned, but I'll put links in there so you guys can check out recommendations for how I got started in poetry and how other people got started. And these are even recommendations that people mentioned in the talks in Cleveland. But just to real quick, I'm going to be reading one poem from Lisa's talk that I really loved. I loved all of them, of course. They're amazing. But there's one that I had kind of glanced over in the past, but hadn't really focused on. It's called To Solitude. And she gave us these nice little pamphlets, booklets of the poetry from John Keats. And it's called To Solitude. And I wanted to focus as quickly as possible, or as much as possible today, on this poem and a quick comparison with a poem that I've covered numerous times on this show in the past, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by John Wordsworth. And I want to make a point today, and I want to, make a quick point, quick as possible, about what poetry does. One of the things that it does and why it is not optional, it should not be an optional thing. And I noticed in talking to people, there's so much stuff about music and sculpture. And of course, literature is number one in my view, even though it's not in Yaron's view number one, but I think it's, it's my hierarchy number one. And for you, it's something that you should add a little bit into your life, novels, but poetry too. And poetry, in a sense, is more accessible because you don't have to read 1,000 pages. You could read 17 lines and have your whole consciousness elevated. So I just want to give you a taste of the difference, that there is a fundamental difference in what poetry does and how it can add to your life little by little. But first, let me give you a couple of things, very brief synopsis to give you some of my experience with poetry and where I am now, with some recommendations for where to get started. So just, I hated I loved reading literature as a teenager. I've always been a reader, but I always hated poetry. Always, always, always. It never made sense to me. It was garbly gook. It didn't make any sense. Until I was 28, and I'm going to put this on the screen here. And I saw, and I listened to Poems I Like and Why, and you can get this at the Ayn Rand Institute, by Leonard Peikoff. And this is not a philosophical discussion. He does a great job of, he's talking about from why he likes it, and he talks about poems like the If Poem, Richard Corey. There's a whole bunch of great poems in here. And he does talk about what poetry does to you emotionally. It's very good. It's a simple introduction that will inspire you to read more poetry. Another one I really recommend, and listening to Lisa Van Dam's work in general, I highly recommend. It's very good. It's where I learn a lot of the stuff that I do about how I do poetry. One that I really love is Rizpah. It's the theme is kind of about the motherhood, essentially, and I'm not a mother, but it still touched me. And I, maybe it's very special because I was able to actually see Lisa teach this to a room full of eighth graders, and that was amazing to see. This little YouTube page, you go to just, I'll put it in the links, but I think if you go to Van Dam Academy on YouTube, you can find it. or, you know, like I said, I'll put a link in there that will, you know, for I'll put links for all this stuff. Last year, I missed it this live, but Lisa did Falling in Love with Poetry, with two parts. I highly recommend that as well. And then, of course, there is the Read With Me app. So go to readwithmebookgroup.com. Now, she does mostly short stories at this point, but she does have Rizpah on here, and she might have some other poems occasionally come up. I'm not exactly sure how many poems she's doing, but she's focused on novels. But you still get a taste for what it is that makes literature great: novels, short stories, and poetry. So anyway, just a couple little links I wanted to give you and some recommendations. Again, I highly recommend those. They're very valuable in teaching you how to access inaccessible literature, which much of it is. Okay, let's get into a quick little discussion of To Solitude by John Keats. And I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by, actually, let me get rid of this thing, by Wordsworth. And I want to focus on, I'll talk about the actual words and what's going on in the poem a little bit, not as in depth as I usually do, or try to. And, but I do want to, like I said, point out one thing that I think poetry does in our consciousness that is very valuable to living life and improving our one life on this earth. Okay, so here is To Solitude. I'll read it if you didn't get a chance to listen to Lisa, although Lisa's, I think the YouTube video hopefully will be up as quickly so you can listen to her read it. She's much better at reading it than I am. O solitude, if I must with thee dwell, let it not be among the jumbled heap of murky buildings. Climb with me the steep, nature's observatory, whence the dell its flowery slopes, its river's crystal swell, may seem a span. Let me thy vigils keep mongst boughs pavilioned, where the deer's swift leap startles the wild bee from the foxglove bell. But though I'll gladly trace these scenes with thee, yet the sweet converse of an innocent mind, whose words are images of thoughts refined, is my soul's pleasure, and it's sure must be almost the highest bliss of humankind when to thy haunts two kindred spirits flee. So the one thing to keep in mind with poetry is, one question to ask is, who is speaking? And in this case, who is he speaking to? To whom is he speaking? He is speaking to a kind of personified solitude. And solitude means being alone. We all know what being alone is. There is a lot of research going on, and there are books, I'm trying to remember, one book called Deep Work by Cal Newport, where he talks about embracing boredom. And what he talks about, what he means by that is, because we live in such a loud world, when we, for instance, stand in line or any, you know, a long line at Starbucks, or we're alone for just a few minutes, automatically, boom, our phones pop up and we're on Facebook. We rarely spend any time alone. We rarely spend any time in quiet. We rarely spend any time contemplating. And contemplating is something that's been a theme at OCON 2019, because that's what Ayn Rand said was the ultimate end. It's an end in of itself. It's a fuel of man. But the way that you gain that fuel is through contemplation. If you just look at a painting in a gallery and you just walk by it and you, oh, that's pretty, and you walk by, that's not gaining fuel. You need to look at it and analyze it and think about it and let the emotion pour over you. It's the same thing with poetry and literature and, you know, even music and sculpture and all forms of art. So this is a paean, a vigil, a prayer, an homage to solitude. He is talking to a personified, Keats is talking to a personified solitude. He's saying, "O solitude, if I must with thee dwell, with you dwell, let it not be among the jumbled heap of murky buildings." So this is not an Ayn Rand idea of, you know, murky buildings, meaning kind of confused in the jumble of civilization. You know, the Romantics were very much nature poets often, and lovers of nature, which is nothing wrong with nature. And I actually appreciate this about them. So he's saying, you know, the civilization is often loud and murky and gets in the way of this kind of contemplation. But again, if you think about the iPhones, there is some truth to this. So don't, you know, just because he's maybe making a knock on buildings doesn't mean there's not something here. Where the dell, whence the dell? It's flowery slopes, like a little hill with flowers. So he's, again, now we're entering nature. Oh, excuse me, I skipped a line. So he wants to get out of murky buildings, and he's talking to solitude. He's saying, "Solitude, come with me. Oh, solitude, if I'm going to dwell with you, let's go over here. Let's climb with me this steep. Let's go to nature's observatory," right? Think about an observatory on a hill that looks out into the sky, you know, into the heavens, into space, into stars. It's like that, but we're going to look at the observatory, nature's observatory, and observe nature. Whence the bell, where the dell, its flowery slopes, its rivers, crystal swell. So, you know, we're getting nature imagery. May seem a span. We're going to see it forever. It's going to span out into the distance. And the time may expand with it. Let me your vigils keep. Let me keep a vigil for you and a light, a candle in your honor and pray to you. Amongst boughs, the tree limbs, pavilioned. So think about a pavilion over your head. So he's making a home in nature. And you see, this is pretty common with a lot of these guys. Is they're saying, "Oh, I'm going to make like a little bed, and I'm going to put like a hammock here, and we're going to chill here in nature. But we're not going to really make much. We're just going to use what nature gives us, and we're just going to kind of sit here." And that can sometimes not be the best idea, but you know, that's what they're getting at is that kind of idea of living, becoming one with nature. Let me your vigils keep amongst boughs pavilioned, where the deer's swift leap startles the wild bee from the foxglove bell. So, you know, again, just more imagery of your deer's leaping and startling bees is just part of nature, from the foxglove bell, you know, like a certain type of flower, the foxglove. But though I'll gladly trace these scenes with thee. So in my mind, oh, solitude. Remember, he's talking to solitude. In my mind, solitude, I'll talk about the deer. Oh, look at that deer. He startled that bee. Oh, how beautiful. I just saw, I think Linda Cordero posted something of a bee, a close-up shot of a bee in like a little, some type of flower with its butt sticking up. And it says like a meme, something like, you know, "This will make your day. Here's a flower butt if you needed this today," something like that. But, you know, just the idea of appreciating, you know, and the beauty of nature just as it is. And he's saying, "But though I'll gladly trace these scenes with thee, yet the sweet converse of an innocent mind, whose words are images of thoughts refined," whose words are images, think about that, "whose words are images of thoughts refined." So he's talking about what poetry is and what words do to the mind. And he's saying, "I'll trace these, I'll have this conversation with you, is my soul's pleasure." And again, who is he talking to? Solitude. He's talking to being alone. He's, you know, it's himself. It's being out in nature with just himself. "And it sure must be almost the highest bliss of humankind when to your haunts, two kindred spirits flee." So there is a reverence for what can, in romantic poetry in particular, for what the human mind can do when it's alone, imagine, contemplate. There is a deep appreciation in Keats in particular, because he dies at a young age, so he's still in this age of his life of really falling, you know, loving what art does to you. You know, and there's something special about, if you want to understand what art does to you, you can read, you can listen to me, you can listen to Lisa, But really, Keats is telling you what it does to you right here. And he's organizing the ideas in your mind. He's saying, here's a personified solitude. Let's me in solitude. Hey, buddy, solitude. Let's walk hand in hand and in this grove and let's talk about this beautiful, you know, these beautiful things. And he's commenting on, and his poem is that contemplation. And since you can't write this or probably write this quality, use his words for the same reasons. Okay, so let's move on to I Wander Lonely as a Cloud. I've covered this many times. I'm going to try to go through it quite a bit quicker. Just I want you to get a taste for what this can be. And if you have questions, we can, you know, I'll do it again if you really want to. I think it's a great poem. It's one of the great poems about what this, the same idea that Keats is dealing with in terms of what solitude can do for you, what it, you know, feels like to be alone, and what art can do in that moment of loneliness or being alone and contemplating. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. Beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. So real quick, just I'm going to give you a little bit of what's going on in the poem. So I want you to kind of explore it a little bit. And then I want to end by talking about what poetry does, or one thing it does that is essential to living. So we have this character, this guy, this narrator, Wordsworth himself, and he's wandering lonely as a cloud. He's, you know, and think about that as a comparison. Poetry is about comparison heavily, and metaphor and simile and analogy. He is relating the speaker to a cloud. One of the things we do that clouds make us think of course, you know, often, not always, is laying down as kids and imagining figures in clouds, right? But even just you see like a cloud, it's this lonely cloud that we see that kind of dissipates and it's fluffy and airy and ephemeral. Well, that's how this character is right now. And he's just kind of floating around. I wander lonely as a cloud that floats on high over vales and hills. So he's wandering here and he has this overview of all of, you know, the world. When all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. So you have green land, let's say, for miles. And then you walk around a corner, poof, daffodils, like a whole host of them, tens of thousands, a whole sea of them. Beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Now he's going to relate the daffodils, get a comparison to the stars. Now there's a big difference between a flower that dies and the stars, but there's now he's saying, so again, when we're talking about metaphors, is there's similarities and differences. This is important to thinking. This is important to your consciousness, is noticing similarities and noticing differences. So what does a man have in common with a cloud? What do daffodils have in common with stars? What do they have different? So continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way. So he's comparing them now. And so one thing they have in common with them is that they have a color in common with them, perhaps, with the stars. Also, he's going to be relating them to his mind. So just like the stars have this fixed nature to them, these daffodils do too. Even though we know the daffodils are not going to be there forever. but in a sense they will. And this is the conclusion. You know, he's setting up he has a thesis that, you know what, I know that daffodils blow away and they die and the winter's going to come and everything's going to happen, but there's going to be a sense where they're going to be eternal, just like the stars. What's that sense? Because that doesn't 100% make sense. We need the conclusion. So he's setting it up and it's like, wait a second, how? You know, if you're following along, it should be, this doesn't make sense. This is illogical to say that these temporary flowers are like the permanent stars. That's not quite right. But he's making an argument that it is. They stretched a never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. So now he's, you know, making them personified and making them like a person dancing around like a nymph or something in the woods. The waves besides them dance. So they dance, the wave dance, like along the margin of a bay. But they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. So now he's comparing them to the ocean, and the ocean is permanent too, like the waves, I mean, like the stars. Okay, now we're going to get the conclusion, his answer to the thesis about the eternality of these ephemeral, temporary things. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. So he's focusing now on the gazing. I gazed. That's the key element here. That's the key part of this. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth to me, what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. Solitudium. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. So the eternality of daffodils for the poet is him. It's this poem. The reason that, in a sense, the poem is eternal, right? I'm reading it in 2019, and this is written, when was this written, actually? So it was published in 1804. It was inspired by an event in 1802, which I'll finish up by talking about the event. And the Keats poem To Solitude was published in 1816. You know, I think it's pretty clear that Keats was inspired by Wordsworth. He loved Wordsworth. He was a huge admirer. He called him, his work is the egotistical sublime, which he meant in a, I think, pretty positive way, actually. But anyway, I'm reading this in 2019. He wrote this in 1802. So in a sense, and Shakespeare and Keats both make this argument about art, is that it's eternal because the poet wrote it down. And, you know, that there's a kind of egotism in there that those daffodils from 1802 do exist right here. If you're looking on the page, then it's there. And it's in the mind of the poet Wordsworth. But now if you close your eyes and you see daffodils because of this poem, he has transferred that into your mind. He has transported through words into your mind. This is what art does. And he has said something eternal about what the power of solitude, what is the power of imagination, what is the power of contemplation. It all, you know, resonates as one thing. And you're getting comparisons between the eternality. Eternity is one of the things he's talking about, or the idea that these things will not only live forever in mankind, but there is a connection that you have with them. And that the beauty of that we can see in our mind from his words is similar to the beauty he actually experienced. So it's him tracing, you know, what the power of the imagination is, seeing a star, relating it to a daffodil, and so on and so forth. You know, going on in, with all the different metaphors that he talks about with the bay, even the way that he talks about vales and hills and so on. Okay, this is the last thing I'm going to do. He relates this to the inspiration for Wordsworth, if you're watching the Facebook page, is this journal entry by his sister Dorothy. So this is the conclusion here. What poetry does, it's different than prose. So you cannot get this in novels. No matter how great the novel is, there is something missing. There's something that only poetry can do. So here's the journal entry that inspired, that would, you'll see similarities to the poem. When we were in the woods beyond Grow Barrow Park, we saw a few daffodils close to the waterside. We fancied that the lake had floated the seed ashore and that the little colony had so sprung up. But as we went along, there were more and yet more, and at last, under the boughs of the trees, we saw that there was a long belt of them along the shore, about the breadth of a country turnpike road. So she's making metaphors and images, and she's comparing the what they saw to a turnpike road, for instance. And here's the important passage. I never saw daffodils so beautiful. They grew among the mossy stones about and about them. Some rested their heads upon these stones as on a pillow for weariness, and the rest tossed and reeled and danced and seemed as if they verily laughed with the wind and blew upon them over the lake. They looked so gay, ever dancing, ever changing. The wind blew directly over the lake to them. There was here and there a little knot and a little few stragglers, a few yards higher up, but they were so few as not to disturb the simplicity and unity and life of that one busy highway. We rested again and again. The bays were stormy, and we heard the waves at different distances and in the middle of the water like the sea. That's prose. It's good prose. It's enjoyable prose. You know, it's just a journal entry, but it's still, it's enjoyable prose. There's images. It's, you know, we get a sense for this beautiful scene that she saw in nature, and she's describing the beautiful scene. But there's a big difference between that and the totality of the world that Wordsworth has created in one, two, three, four stanzas with meter, rhyme, rhythm, and a precision of word choice. Right? He's doing, it's a very simple scene of a man just walking around, excuse me, and he sees this daffodils, and then it makes him think of something. Because what in effect he has done is he has expressed to you, the reader, what emotional associations he has made in regard to the or what associations he has made in this state of excitement, or in this case of imaginative contemplation that came from looking at those daffodils. And then, you know, instead of the wonderful prose, we get, I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. And it sticks in your mind. It trains the rhythm of your mind to see the world in a similar way that music does. And I think, you know, one of the things I love about poetry is it does what literature does. It does what short stories do, novels, and music. It does all of those things. The thing that you would get with the training of the rhythm of your mind, it, you know, it's not going to be as powerful as music, but it does that as well. Okay, so that's pretty much what I wanted to say is what it does is it gives you metaphors and ways of looking at the world. Metaphorical thinking, I think, is critical for actual thinking. If you've ever been, you know, if you're at the OCON conference, or if you've ever talked ideas with people and it doesn't seem like you're landing with them, often what helps is what Ayn Rand called concretizing, or giving examples. But this means metaphors, analogies, similes. And if you want to be able to pull up those kind of things, you know, Ayn Rand said to be able to be a good thinker, you need to be able, here's a metaphor. You need to be able to dance between abstractions and concretes. You need to be able to, and she called it a dance, and I think that's an important way to think about it. And that's what poetry teaches you, gives you, is it helps you to dance. Thank you, and I will see you next time. And make sure to check out Lisa Van Dam's work. I think it's amazing. And she's been doing this, you know, I've learned, you know, a lot of what she gave me, all these recommendations, like Elizabeth Drew, which I think she mentioned in her course. Like, she gave me so much, and then listening to all of her courses were incredible and have helped guide me to learn more about poetry and be able to access stuff like this on my own, which took years, but, you know, listening to all her courses and other things, and Peacock's as well. So please check it out. Go to readwithmebookgroup.com and, you know, learn more about poetry. Okay, I'll see you next time, and I'll next Sunday I will do my best to do a slumber. Did my what's it called? I want to make sure I get it right. It's the fifth Lucy, the fifth Lucy poem that I've done. Not there's not an order to them, but it's A Slumber Did My Spirit Seal, and I wanted to use this one. It's very short. It's one short stanza. I wanted to use this one as a way into looking at all the five Lucy poems and why those are usually categorized together. I think it's useful to categorize and read and analyze and study and appreciate and contemplate and imagine and sit on your couch and, you know, be in your inner bliss. Okay, that's it for me. See you next week. And I hope you enjoyed OCON. OCON 2020 is in Austin, Texas, baby.